Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 26, recorded Tuesday, December 20th, 2005. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler more about the journey than the destination. Only two topics on today's Travel Commons Podcast: disconnect, business travel in a resort, and the explosion of elites. Hey, this week coming to you from the bathroom of the Philadelphia Marriott, right in the middle of Center City, Philadelphia. I'm at the tail end of this year's final triangulation. This time I did the Northeast, Boston, Providence, Rhode Island, and now Philadelphia. Luck kept me out of New York, so I got to miss today's transit strike. Lucky me. Flew into Boston Monday morning for a lunch meeting, then drove down to Providence for an afternoon meeting, and then screamed down I-295 to Green Airport and caught the 5:20 p.m. Southwest flight to Philadelphia. And I'll tell you, screaming is the right word. I hit the Hertz rental lot in Logan Monday morning and was, quite honestly, initially put out. Would be a nice way to say it, because my name wasn't on the Hertz Gold board. And you know, that's the whole reason why you do the Hertz Gold or Avis Preferred, is you get in, you see your name, you got a number, boom, you're in the car, boom, you're out. Remember, you know, business travel is all about efficiency. And so when you don't see your name on the board, that means you got to go in, queue up, and figure out what they didn't get right. However, I'll tell you what, though, my put-out-ness, if I can make that a word, quickly dissipated when the Hertz guy handed me the keys to a brand new Infiniti G35 with satellite radio. I mean, this thing was cranked up. What a great car! And it really made me glad for the hour drive from Boston to Providence. Indeed, you know, when I checked it in at Providence Airport, the Hertz guy was just practically drooling over this car. He's like, hey, how did it go? How did it drive? How fast did you take it? Only 80? Do you think that they could do 100? What do you think? It was a great car. And then in Philadelphia, my name was on the Hertz Gold board, but when I got to the stall, there was a white Pontiac Montana minivan waiting for me. No, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't spoil the sort of lingering remembrance of the G35 with some godforsaken minivan. So I went back to the Hertz Gold Shack and stood in the cold, waiting for a replacement car. I'll tell you, the Philadelphia Hertz setup is the worst I've ever seen. No building, just a booth with two cold women, a space heater, and a couple of terminals. I really felt sorry for the women working in there. I mean, one of the women was wearing gloves with the fingers cut out so she could work the keyboard. I look at it this way, she said, it can only get better. You know, if I'd taken the train to Philly, then I could have claimed a whole Planes, Trains, and Automobiles trip. You know, that's the classic holiday travel movie for you. Steve Martin and the late John Candy, you know, living the Christmas travel nightmare. No matter what they do, they just can't get home in time for Christmas. You know, I feel like I'm cutting it a little close with the holiday traffic. But once I hit the ground tomorrow morning, Wednesday morning, I'm putting the suitcase in the basement for the rest of the year. All 10 days of it. But, you know, I'll tell you, this last trip was a relatively easy one. No major deliverables to hammer out, just some light meetings, and quite honestly, a fairly loose schedule, which was really nice. I'm staying here at the Philadelphia Marriott, even though my meetings are out in the suburbs, out in Newtown. And at least half the reason that I'm here is because it's across the street from the Reading Terminal Market. And, you know, for those of you who aren't familiar, the Reading Terminal Market is a rarity. Maybe the only place I've run into something similar to the Reading Terminal Market was a market I sort of tripped across in Florence, Italy. And then again, now that I think about it, the downtown covered market in Budapest is very sort of similar. A great combination of open air grocery stalls, really, you know, selling people people their daily food, fishmongers, butchers, bakers, cheese shops, and then eating places, eating counters. You know, it's not some sort of pseudo-Disney thing like Boston's Faneuil Hall or Chicago's Navy Pier. I mean, you do have tourists wandering around, but you've got regular Philadelphians here shopping at their greengrocers or picking up some pork neck bones to make red gravy. I mean, when my wife and I lived in Philadelphia, we lived here from 88 until 92, and on Saturdays, our grocery shopping was going down to South Philly to the Italian market to pick up usually vegetables, stuff like that, down at 9th and Christian, and then we go up to the Reading Terminal Market to pick up fish and meat and stuff like that. And so that, I mean, that, you know, Reading Terminal was our grocery store. You know, the Reading Terminal Market, like I said, I mean, it's been there forever. It's been there since 1892. And what's always just been surprising to me that it still works. It's still the same. And even more so, the city managed not to screw it up when they were renovating it as part of the convention center build out. So I loved it. Great, and I'm glad my schedule was loose enough that I was able to get over there. And then this evening, complete different change. I ate at Morimoto's at 7th and Chestnut. Great food, and you know, it was one of those travel experiences that I really wished I could have shared with my wife. The restaurant is run by Masaharu Morimoto, who's one of the Food Network's Iron Chefs. And Irene just loves that show and always wanted to try the restaurant. You know, unfortunately, though, my descriptions will have to do for her, because I just thought it would be just a little too odd to take pictures of each course with my cell phone camera. You know, I did grab a fun box of matches for her, but now I got to figure out how to get them past the TSA. You know, way back in Travel Commons number 7, back in June, tough to believe I've been doing this long, we talked about strategies for eating alone without looking like a complete loser. And eating at the sushi bar is definitely top of the list. And so at Morimoto's, I went back to the sushi bar, and the sushi bar sort of combined with an open kitchen station, so a range and some broilers behind the sushi station. So not only do you get to sit and eat and not look like an idiot because you're eating alone, but there's just it's great to watch. So it's great entertainment. So you're not just there shoveling food and leaving. There's really, you know, some interaction. You get to a lot of times get to sort of chat with some of the chefs, and it was great watching the line chefs work. I mean, having spent some time on the line in my younger days, I can definitely appreciate it. I watched one woman prepare the sashimi sampler. Her attention to detail was just complete. Putting the caviar on top of a chunk of ototo, she just sort of worked it till it was this neat pyramid of black eggs, black spheres, on top of the gray-red of the tuna. And then she pulled out a small parsley leaf. And right before she was ready to put that sort of green leaf on top of the black, on top of the red, she worked it, pulled just a slight stem out to make sure that it would lay flat on top of that pyramid, and then placed it atop of the caviar. Now, I'll tell you, the recipient of that dish would not have noticed that extra bit of stem, or, you know, if one of the caviar eggs had been sort of out of place. You know, the lighting in this, the lighting in Morimoto's wasn't that bright, which actually made this woman's dedication to perfection just that much more impressive. It's those changes in my attitudes, changes in attitudes, nothing remains quite the same. All of our running and all of our cunning, if we couldn't laugh, we would all go insane. The first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast, Disconnect, the challenges of business travel in a resort. As I mentioned in last week's podcast, I was in Breckenridge, Colorado, in the ski area last weekend. Picked up 3 days of skiing. Great base. Cold. Really cold. Got out of the car the first day, minus 4 degrees. But it was great skiing. On Saturday, we got a bit of a late start. I was up skiing with my dad, and we ended up eating breakfast at the lodge, in the lodge at the base of Peak 9 there in Breckenridge. And in the cafeteria line, as I'm waiting, I'll tell you, the grill guy must have said dude to me six times in two sentences, all the while sort of waving my breakfast burrito just out of my reach. I eventually was able to snare it from him before sort of he got onto the third refrain of the dude song. You know, it wasn't a big deal though. I'm on vacation. The lifts didn't open for another half hour, so I wasn't in a hurry, though maybe a bit hungry. However, if I'd been on business, it would have been another matter. You know, there are obviously different rhythms, different needs between business and leisure travelers. On business, it's all about efficiency, predictability. On vacation, it's all about relaxation, searching out the unique experience. Almost the exact opposites. No wonder a business person staying at a resort often gets the opposite of what's intended. No efficiency, and therefore certainly no relaxation. Chris Chufo, a longtime Travel Commons listener, got me thinking about this whole topic with the following note. When traveling on business in a resort or vacation area, should you have different expectations for service? For example, I recently had a meeting in West Palm Beach, Florida, and decided to stay at a chain hotel, a Marriott. The reasoning was that I would know what I would be getting, and that they would be able to meet any basic needs I had during my business trip. The hotel was a resort timeshare on the beach with five huge towers that they also rented out as hotel rooms at a deal for that time of year. Just one small but significant example. Both mornings, I did not receive my wake-up call. Probably fine if you're on vacation and no place to go except for a chair on the beach. But when I had a business meeting one morning and an early flight the next, and by the way, the snooze button was broken on the in-room clock radio, it was important that I receive the call, especially since my body clock was 3 hours behind on West Coast time. You know, this question applies to hotels, rental cars, airlines, and, you know, I don't expect business service at some hole in the wall in Baja or on the island puddle jumper in the Caribbean. I'm thinking of, you know, name brand airlines, hotel chains, restaurants, where in my mind, service should be consistent between locations. Well, of course, the answer to her question, should there be different expectations, is no. There should be a common expectation of service across all properties of a brand like Marriott. I mean, after all, that's why they have brand standards and service training and field quality auditors. And that's one of the reasons that you choose a recognized brand. You're looking for a level of service that meets your needs. And in Chris's case, a dependable wake-up call and a working clock radio. You know, not too much to ask. But the way the hotel industry has sort of subdivided itself makes this simple request sometimes a challenge. You know, it used to be that brand like Marriott or Hilton took the reservation, owned the property, hired the staff. They completely controlled the guest experience. There was vertical integration, all for the guest. Today, however, it's completely blown apart. The property is owned by a REIT, a real estate investment trust. It's run by a hotel management company, which franchises a brand. And the franchisor doesn't want to be too hard on quality because the property may jump ship to another brand, costing them the franchise fee. Chris's experience with a timeshare renting out spare rooms is even worse. The property's primary purpose, that management company, what they're trying to do, they're not trying to be a hotel. They're trying to sell beds on a timeshare basis. You know, just the hotel thing is just there to sort of pick up some spare change during the slow season. Of course, it would be nice if they'd spend a bit of that spare change on alarm clocks, or at least one for the front desk. Second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast, the explosion of elites. You know, getting on my United flight Sunday night, returning to Chicago from Denver, the guy in front of me on the jet bridge turned and asked, "Have you ever seen so many people in seating group one?" And then on United, seating group one is sort of the status pre-boarding group for United, the Premier, Premier Exec, 1K. And I looked at him, I said, yeah, believe it or not, I have seen it. One time I was on a flight from Cleveland to O'Hare, and the gate agent announced that everyone on the flight had status. Every person on that flight was in seating group one. So she said, look, you know, you're all going to crowd up here. You're all going to try and get on at the same time. It's just not going to work. So we're going to go back to the old-fashioned way. We're going to board by row number. So everybody start looking at your boarding pass now. You know, airline elite status usually comes with, you know, sort of precious metal flavors, silver, gold, platinum for Northwest, platinum, gold, platinum, and executive platinum for American. And, you know, it's been viewed, you know, these statuses have been viewed up till now as almost as valuable, although lately there's been a bit of displacement of that currency. One estimate says that the number of statused flyers, folks who hit the elite levels, could grow by over 300,000 in 2006. That's an 8% increase. And it's not just because people are flying more. The airlines, especially the bankrupt ones, have been trying to convert that perceived value of status into some real cash to help them get out of bankruptcy. United has offered flyers double elite qualifying miles through December 15th, so that program just ended a few days ago, in exchange for a $200 fee. There's a cash-raising exercise. And now Delta resold $500 million of Sky Miles to Amex, and now, in trying to drive business toward Amex, is offering customers 10,000 elite qualifying miles to anyone who charges $25,000 on a Platinum Sky Miles Amex card. You know, though much of the press has focused on sort of the increased competition for a limited set of first-class upgrades, the two most important elite perks on a day-to-day basis are pre-boarding and the elite security lines. In podcast number 21, we talked about airlines experimenting with more efficient boarding approaches. The only people actually who really cared about it were the elites, and that's because they thought their pre-board was going to be taken away. They cared a lot. Places like the Flyer Talk board was just screaming until someone, probably an airline employee, pointed out to everyone the paragraph in the press announcement that said pre-boarding wasn't affected. Then everybody sort of settled back down. The frequent traveler wants to get their black rolling suitcase in the overhead right above them, their coat on top, and then get situated in their seats before the leisure crowds roll in and start filling the overheads with guitars and potted plants and anything else. And I'll tell you, I've been amazed at some of the things I've seen shoved into an overhead. And for the frequent traveler, it's all about efficiency. I want to get on. I want to get my bag on so it doesn't have to be gate checked. So when I get off the plane, I can get out and get on my business. See my name on the Hertz Gold board and move on. You know, indeed, I've actually noticed lately that some of the airlines are starting to split their pre-boarding by elite level. American actually boards the first class and their upper elite, platinum and executive platinum, first, and then boards their Advantage Gold folks, and then boards everybody else. So you're already starting to see a little bit of that discounting, at least at the first level of elite. The elite security line, though, is probably less appreciated, but more important. Even if the elite line is longer, I always go for it. It's not just the length of the line, but who's in it. Frequent travelers, and we've talked about this before, have a rhythm and are much more efficient than the occasional travelers. And that's not a knock against the occasional travelers. It's just, you know, just sheer practice for the frequent travelers. And so even when it's longer, the elite line will go faster because the people in it know the drill. Letting people buy their way into that line, though, just blows that efficiency. My daughter and I were in the elite security line in Denver on Sunday, and I drilled into her the need to be ready and to be crisp. No dawdling, I told her. No dawdling in the elite line. Get those boots unzipped and get that little backpack with the stuffed Build-A-Bear dog. Get that thing ready to get up and get on the X-ray machine belt. However, right in front of us was an obvious amateur, a real poser. The woman was first sort of pulling and tugging to get off her fashionable half-calf cowgirl boots, and then finally remembered to unzip her purse and pull out her laptop. All the while now, she was standing at the front of the x-ray machine, so no one else could get access to sort of the gray bins and start to get their stuff sequenced to go through the x-ray machine. So not only did she take up a lot of time herself, she blew everybody out from getting on and getting sort of that smooth transit. She committed the ultimate sin. She left blank conveyor belt space in front of that x-ray machine. And she was just oblivious to the stares of everyone else in the line. She just took her own sweet time about getting her bag up onto that x-ray belt. And you know, here lies the real danger of those credit card elite status schemes. People spending lots of money on fashionable clothes are going to end up getting elite status, and then they're going to gum up the works, struggling to get off those fashionable, ill-fitting shoes and belts and jackets. Give those frequent chargers a special line, but at the mall. Leave the security lines to unfashionable people like me. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 26. Thanks for listening and staying subscribed. And remember, it's your travel stories, your travel experiences, that voice of the traveler that are at the core of Travel Commons. So please send them along to comments@travelcommons.com or post them on our website at travelcommons.com. Thanks for all the notes and all the feedback. Well, even though I am off the road for the end of the year, I'm pretty sure that I'll have an after Christmas podcast. I've got a good bit of material stored up, so I should give you something to try your new iPods or other MP3 gizmos on. Until then, though, have a very Merry Christmas, and I hope that you can take the time to enjoy what should be for everybody the happiness of the season. So take care, Merry Christmas, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye now.